From Virginia to Texas, Maine to Kansas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, skyrocketing debt and a failure to restrain spending has resulted in an historic downgrade of the federal government's bond rating. Keith Hall from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. Yet another grand jury has indicted former President Donald Trump, this time for his role in contesting results of the 2020 election. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Can the federal government screw up something as simple as labeling products containing sesame seeds? Yes, they can. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And explosive congressional testimony in the Hunter Biden scandal was knocked off the front pages by the latest Trump indictment. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the story should not be buried. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The credit rating agency Fitch has downgraded the federal government's credit rating from AAA to AA+. What is the impact of the downgrade, and will it impact the average American household? To find out, we turn to Keith Hall. Keith is a former director of the Congressional Budget Office and served as chief economist to the White House Council on Economic Advisers. He is currently a distinguished fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Keith, welcome to American Radio Journal. Keith, when we talk about a bond rating for the federal government, really all governments at any level, federal, state, county, municipal, all have a bond rating. What do we mean by that? What is the bond rating and why is it important?
Certainly for the federal government, we routinely and have for years outspend our tax revenue. In fact, we outspend it lately. We've been outspending it by 30% quite a bit. So if you outspend your tax revenue, you got to make up the difference by borrowing money, which is issuing bonds. And this matters. The bond rating matters because it determines the interest rate that the federal government has to pay to borrow all this money. So if they're issuing debt, new debt, they put it out for bid, and people bid on it to buy the debt up, and the federal government pays them interest for holding that debt for a while. Now, U.S. government has always had a very strong bond rating and a very strong reputation. So when they sell debt in our name, they get a very low interest rate. They don't have to pay quite so much in interest. Well, what's happened now is really kind of two things. One is we've accumulated a huge amount of debt. And because we have such a huge amount of debt, a fair amount of our federal spending is just paying the interest on this debt that's sitting there, just like anybody would have to pay interest on a credit card or a mortgage or something. And when the credit rating goes down a little bit, it's signaling to investors that these credit bureaus have lost a little bit, say, of faith in the federal government's ability and willingness to pay the money back into the future. And if they're losing confidence in the federal government's ability to pay back all this debt, then future money that gets lent to the government, and they'll keep borrowing, is going to have a little bit of a higher interest rate. It's going to cost them more, and it's going to cost us more, because they'll have to borrow additional money to pay the interest on the old debt.
So as the federal government starts paying more in interest on new debt, do they also have old debt that has to be refinanced that will also be subject to the higher rates?
Yes, and it's very sensitive because of that. That's an excellent point, because the U.S. Treasury has taken the strategy that they're going to issue debt in fairly short amount of time, where the debt matures in just a few years. And rather than pay any of it back when debt matures, and it constantly matures, they'll reissue new debt to pay for the old debt. So this is like having your credit card balance get too high, so you get another credit card and use that credit card to pay off the old credit card. So they're constantly churning this debt, refinancing it constantly. So that means it's very sensitive to the interest rate. So lately, for example, we've had the interest rates go up because of all the inflation, the Federal Reserve's trying to control inflation. That's added tremendously to the interest that the federal government has to pay. In fact, it's literally adding trillions of dollars to just the interest cost of debt over the next 10 years at the rate we're going. So having this credit rating get lowered means it's going to be yet another little boost to the interest cost of holding all this debt by the federal government.
This sounds a bit like a vicious cycle of more debt, rating goes down, costs more to borrow, therefore you take on more debt. Has the federal government, has Congress done anything recently to try to bring this under control, or is the wanton spending still continuing?
Well, the best thing they've done was the Fiscal Responsibility Act. And that was the act that resolved the debt ceiling crisis or debt ceiling debate. And it was actually legislation that put caps on spending and actually lowered federal spending over the next 10 years. So that was actually real progress. But the problem with that is debt's really big. And by lowering the trend on borrowing a little bit, that's progress. It's not nearly enough. And so having the credit rating by Fitch in particular now, having them lower their credit rating, they're beginning to lose confidence that the government is taking this debt seriously. And the thing that we really need to do is, one, don't backslide off this deal, the Fiscal Responsibility Act. But two, more importantly, is acknowledge the debt problem. Try to work out some more compromise. Try to work out a plan on maybe how to control this continual borrowing. There have been no signs of that for a while. In fact, the Fiscal Responsibility Act was very difficult to get into place. It was quite contentious, and that use of the debt ceiling to sort of force the negotiations was way more than we should have had to do to get some sort of action to show that we're serious about this continuing debt.
As we look at that whole situation here, Keith, where you had the debt ceiling, we came pretty close to, quote, a default and all that, does this all shake the confidence in rating agencies like Fitch that we haven't really had a federal budget in, what, decades? We're approaching another budget deadline. It's clearly not going to be done. This, it would seem to me, is also going to erode confidence in the bond markets, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. And that's exactly right. I logged some time at the Congressional Budget Office, which is the organization that works for Congress and gives Congress advice on debt. And the Congressional Budget Office for years, really decades, has been warning Congress and the president that if they keep raising debt, then the financial markets are going to lose confidence in the federal government's ability to repay the debt. And it's going to create problems. It's going to create risk of some sort of financial crisis. And while this isn't, you know, having the debt rating go down a little bit, that's not a financial crisis, but that's a step on the path to a financial crisis.
We have been talking with Keith Hall, who is a distinguished senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Keith, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go? You write a lot on these issues. Where can folks go to read your policy papers, your commentary, et cetera?
Well, sure. Well, the real key is to Google Mercatus, and you'll find us. We are a research center. And it's a research center that's part of George Mason University, so it's attached to the university.
Again, we've been talking with Keith Hall, a distinguished fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Keith, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Sure, I enjoyed it. Thank you for your questions.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He has been keeping an eye on the growing number of indictments against former President Donald Trump. Once again, major indictments this past week. We're going to work our way through the entire scenario here with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
So now we have, Scott, the president indicted relative to his actions surrounding January 6th, which, of course, has been a major rallying point for the left and for Democrats now ever since it occurred. Your thoughts on the latest indictment and what impact it might have on the presidential race?
Wow, what a loaded question, Loman. Thanks for teeing me off with the softball today. Well, you know, I got to tell you, brother, this is one of those situations here where I think that people on the right, people that are Trump supporters, have been watching Donald Trump over the last several months close the gap in the head-to-head polling against Joe Biden. Trump has positioned himself as the front runner for the Republican nomination. And there's a lot of people that look at the political timing of the latest indictment here on August 1st as something that is not just coincidental as it pertains to Devon Archer's testimony behind closed doors to Congress related to the Hunter Biden bribes and Joe Biden's involvement with those business dealings. It's not just a coincidence that the pollings have narrowed and that the timing of the indictment comes out right now. It seems like many people on the right believe that this is a situation where it's rules for thee, but not for me, when it comes to the alleged crimes committed by the Biden family and the alleged actions from President Trump in relation to January 6th and the Stormy Daniels indictment, and then also the Mar-a-Lago documents. We know that January 6th is certainly a stain on American history. But that being said, when you think about why so many Americans were marching toward the Capitol and what their frustration ultimately boiled down to was whether or not we had free and fair elections. After 2016, Hillary Clinton began the resistance, right? You had all sorts of people saying that there was Russian interference as to whether Donald Trump was dutifully elected president of the United States. And in 2020, we had a similar reaction with the boomerang on the other side, with many Republicans not trusting the reforms that states took when it came to unconstitutional actions from many governors in blue states where they changed election laws and ran up the score with early voting, mail voting, drop boxes, things that most voters were unfamiliar with. And that just sort of breeded this new uncertainty around the trust and integrity in our electoral system. For a long time, the Democrats used to say, all we really need to do is have a popular vote. Well, they've shifted that messaging away, and now it seems like the Democrats are focused on making permanent these changes that we did in 2020. That's what H.R. 1, when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker, was all about. It was about basically codifying the changes to the electoral system that were made to accommodate voters in 2020. I think that President Trump's top-line messaging related to the indictment is undoubtedly related to election interference. He knows that he's the front runner for the Republican nomination, and he believes that the politicized weaponization at the Department of Justice underneath the Biden administration is interfering in his chances to win in 2024.
It does seem, Scott, like as you look at the timing of all this, that there's got to be something more than just coincidence at play. And we still have ahead of us an investigation that has been taking place in the state of Georgia relative to the post-election maneuvering that occurred in that state. We probably are going to see yet another indictment coming down this month. Do you see that as occurring, as likely to occur?
Well, it's difficult to predict the timing over the next month, and let alone the next 24 hours, right? I think that that's part of what's exciting about politics, is that it's very, very difficult to predict the future. Everybody always talks about the October surprise. Well, what's going to be the surprise in January 2024 or in August of 2024? When are these convictions potentially going to be handed down? There's so many questions related to that. As I look at the most recent indictment here related to January 6th by Jack Smith, there's one thing to keep in mind here. There's very, very serious allegations from President Trump and his role that actually could lead to the death penalty. And if you think about how outrageous that is, I could never imagine the United States of America being a place where we put to death a loser of an election based off of these weaponized and political decisions being made by U.S. Special Counsel Jack Smith. We've looked at Smith's history. We've looked at the activities of his family in relation to supporting Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and others. We know that the Democrat Party is playing for keeps. And for far too long, the Republicans have sort of said, hey, you know, let's let the process play out here. We don't know exactly what happened. Well, I think that there is a growing movement on the political right where they're losing trust, not just in our electoral integrity, but in the judicial system. And that needs to be a big, big concern and a topic of conversation, I think, in the coming weeks as we approach the first debate for the 2024 GOP nomination in Milwaukee.
And we will invite you to stay tuned to Scott Parkinson as we check in with him every week at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on all of these rather extraordinary developments that are taking place. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., united in the idea of economic freedom, opportunity, and liberty. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Food and Drug Administration's plan to label some products containing sesame seeds had some unintended consequences, as we learn now from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
One of the better recent examples of how government officials do a bad job of anticipating the consequences of their own actions came courtesy of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, when they mandated warning labels for products containing sesame seeds. The unanticipated result? Suddenly, a lot more stuff seems to contain sesame seeds. Call this a great moment in unintended consequences. And how the FDA commissioner explained it this past week says a lot about why governments keep making mistakes like this. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. So last week, in part of a regularly published newsletter, FDA Commissioner Robert Califf addressed the unexpected outcome of the FDA's new rules for sesame seeds. He wrote that no one envisioned this happening, which is kind of a silly thing for him to say. But to understand why, we have to actually back up a little bit. So in case you missed this at the time, this happened last year, and here's what went down. In an attempt to aid people who have allergies to sesame seeds, the FDA added the ingredient to its long-standing list of items whose presence must be noted on the packaging of food products and at restaurants. Now, that's a list that includes things like eggs, milk, peanuts. You've probably seen these notices on food wrappers or on menus, although they've actually kind of become so common that my eyes glaze over and I kind of don't even notice them anymore, which actually, I think, defeats the purpose of them. But of course, if you have a food allergy, you probably notice them. These are helpful reminders to avoid certain foods. So last year, the FDA added sesame to that list. And in response, food producers started adding sesame to products that previously didn't contain it. Now, why would they do that? Well, they're actually just doing what makes economic sense. See, the FDA's fines for not disclosing the inclusion of sesame are really steep, and it's much cheaper to just add a few seeds to everything than to face the potential penalties for accidentally mixing. Think about it. If you're running a production line that makes, let's say, hamburger buns or some other bread product, crackers maybe, you might be making products on that same line that includes sesame seed and others that don't. But sesame seeds are really small. They bounce around. They're kind of hard to keep track of. And some cross-contamination in big facilities is just inevitable. It's going to happen. So rather than face the threat of fines and punishments, it's easier sometimes to just add the product, add the sesame seeds deliberately into everything that you make, and then disclose that fact, just include it on the label. Of course, that defeats the purpose here, right? Keep in mind, the government's goal here was to help people who suffer from allergies to sesame, and the end result is more sesame in everything. As my colleague Elizabeth Nolan Brown reported last year when this started happening, some restaurants and food makers, including Olive Garden, Chick-fil-A, and Wendy's, were simply adding sesame to all of their products. That way they can list it as an ingredient, and they don't have to worry about being faulted for accidental cross-contamination. The result? Fewer sesame seed products are now available for people who are allergic to sesame seeds. You know, the very people the government was trying to help. But the cherry on top of this Sunday of government failure, or wait a second, actually the better metaphor here is the sesame seed atop the FDA's bun of bureaucratic bungling, that was provided this week by none other than the agency's own chief, Commissioner Robert Califf. So here's what he wrote in that newsletter that I mentioned earlier. Quote, "Some manufacturers are intentionally adding sesame to products that previously did not contain sesame and are labeling the products to indicate its presence." Califf went on to say that the FDA's goal was to help individuals with sesame allergies, quote, "feel more confident about their choices." Now here's the really important part. He says, quote, I don't think anyone envisioned there being a decrease in the availability of products that are safe choices for sesame allergic consumers. Yes, no one could have possibly envisioned this outcome, except perhaps for the many food processing facilities, the people running those facilities, that immediately responded to the FDA's new rules by doing exactly this thing. Someone could have envisioned this outcome. What Califf means, of course, is that no one within the FDA considered this to be a possibility. That's a telling statement. It indicates that the FDA likely didn't do a good job of investigating how the businesses affected by its rules would respond to the placement of sesame on this federal allergens list. It also suggests that the FDA's staff lacked the ability to see beyond the good intentions, the intentions of helping allergy sufferers, in order to interrogate how such a rule might be implemented in the real world. There's a recurring idea that advancements in technology and data processing can allow governments to solve the so-called knowledge problem. That's what Friedrich Hayek observed years ago, saying that central planners will always fail because government officials cannot aggregate all the necessary information to make better decisions than the various decentralized decisions that are made by individuals acting via the free market every day. Califf's remarks show just how difficult solving that problem really is. The FDA now has virtually unlimited access to public health data, and it can easily acquire whatever information it might need to make any decision. And yet no one at the agency was able to predict how a regulation of a tiny seed would have huge unintended consequences. The FDA was either unwilling or unable to get the necessary information. And there's a lesson there, I think, about the ways all kinds of government regulation happen. Bureaucrats assume that their orders will be followed exactly as intended, but the real world is messy and chaotic, and rarely does anything go as planned. So instead of helping people with food allergies avoid sesame seeds, the government has made sesame seeds harder to avoid. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more about this story and everything else we're working on this week at Reason.com. And while you're there, click over to the Podcasts tab, where you'll find a link to my new podcast series, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. It's a 6-part limited series starting this week, highlighting foolish and sometimes kind of funny ways the government gets in the way when the free market is trying to deliver goods for consumers. In the first episode this week, ironically enough, we're covering the great baby formula crisis of 2022, which was caused in no small part by, well, you guessed it, the FDA. Once again, for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Details of President Joe Biden's involvement in the Hunter Biden business deals got buried as the legacy media focused on the latest Donald Trump indictment. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this American Radio Journal commentary.
The biggest story from this past week is obviously the Washington, D.C. grand jury's indictment of former President Trump by special counsel Jack Smith. The legacy media are breathlessly treating it as one of the biggest stories in the history of the Republic. One headline called it the most important case in U.S. history. Coverage of Trump's troubles is swamping virtually all other stories, which is more than a little convenient, because there's another big story that the same legacy media do not want to cover, and that's what I want to spend the next few minutes examining. That other story, the one that the legacy media is happy to have an excuse to ignore, is the Hunter Biden, Devin Archer, Joe Biden, Burisma political influence scandal. MSNBC treated the Devin Archer testimony before the House Oversight Committee as a nothing burger, claiming that it shows, quote, no evidence of Joe Biden's connection to his son's business affairs, close quote. That's not the way influence peddling works. Does MSNBC think the American people are idiots? No one flat out promises a quid pro quo transaction. It's all done with innuendo. The purpose of innuendo is to provide the opportunity for plausible deniability. Remember the testimony of Michael Cohen about how Donald Trump used a kind of code to give orders to Cohen so that Trump could maintain plausible deniability? Cohen said, quote, he speaks in code. I understand his code. Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis, stated that Trump used coded language to encourage Cohen to falsely state in congressional testimony that there were no contacts between the Trump organization and campaign and people linked to the Russian government. Isn't that exactly like what we have here? When it was Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, the legacy media proudly cracked the code and concluded that it was old-fashioned, corrupt influence peddling, that Trump was guilty of it, yet in this case, we are supposed to give Biden a pass because no pure quid pro quo was proposed. No, it's the same code. Republicans and Democrats offered dueling takes on the significance of Devin Archer's testimony this week, with Republicans saying it provided confirmation that Biden previously lied about his knowledge of his son's business dealings, and Democrats saying the testimony yielded no evidence of wrongdoing and that the conversations never focused on Hunter Biden's business. When it was Trump under the microscope, the media happily fed the Democrats' impeachment momentum by suggesting that anyone could see through the flimsy defense of plausible deniability. This time, the parties are reversed. Democrats are trying to plausibly deny that Joe Biden had anything to do with Hunter Biden's Burisma deal, and Republicans are saying that anyone should be able to crack the coded language. But in this case, we have an added factor that I believe definitively points the finger of blame directly at Joe Biden. His ego got the better of his slippery prevaricating when he bragged to an audience of foreign policy specialists about the time that he strong-armed Ukraine into firing its top prosecutor. In his own words, he threatened the Ukrainian president that the Obama administration would pull $1 billion in U.S. loan guarantees if it didn't immediately fire Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin. Biden said, quote, "I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor is not fired, you're not getting the money," close quote, Biden recalled. Then he proudly said, quote, "Well, he got fired," close quote. Shokin had threatened to investigate the corruption at Burisma. Hunter Biden's client, Burisma, was being accused of corruption. Hunter Biden put Joe Biden on the phone with Burisma executives. Even if they didn't talk explicitly about Viktor Shokin, somewhere along the line, Hunter must have asked his father to use his influence to get Shokin fired. How else would an American vice president ask another country's president to fire one of its prosecutors? Connect the dots. Donald Trump famously called his telephone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky a perfect call. Democrats and the legacy media mocked him mercilessly for it, and the call ultimately led to his impeachment. Joe Biden has had 20 or so telephone calls with Hunter Biden's Ukrainian associates. Democrats and the media are defending them all as perfectly innocent. Republicans and conservative media need to make the same case against Joe Biden that Democrats and the legacy media made against Trump. And if well executed, it should lead to the same result, impeachment. My advice to our loyal American radio listeners is simple. Don't let the media bury the Biden corruption story by distracting you with wall-to-wall coverage of the Trump indictments. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBBC-AM in Ponca City, Oklahoma, KMGZ-FM in Lawton, Oklahoma, along with KSDZ-FM in Gordon, Nebraska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.